Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We have all kinds of ideas about the rich and super rich. We lionize them. We resent them. Many want to be them. Look at lottery ticket sales. But what do you really know about that life, the big money life? A new survey looks at the satisfactions and very human problems that millions and billions can bring. This hour on Point, the real lives of the super rich. You can join the conversation. What do you think? All upside, being rich? Can you see a downside? Have you lived it? Are you thinking, cry me a river? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now in the studio are Paul Shervish, professor of sociology and director of the Center on Wealth and Philanthropy at Boston College. For 4 years, he's been working on a survey on the meaning of money and its consequences in the lives of the super rich. The research was supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the John Templeton Fund, and Wells Fargo. Paul Shervish, welcome to On Point. Great to have you here.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Also with us in the studio is Robert Kenny. He's a partner at Northbridge Advisory Group. They do psychological counseling for wealthy clients working through the emotional and life issues of big money. He's also associate director and visiting scholar at Boston College's Center on Wealth and Philanthropy. He worked with Paul on the center's big survey of the rich. Bob Kenny, thank you very much for being here today.
Delighted to be here. Thank you.
So here we are. We're in a time when there's been so much focus on the accumulation of wealth in this country. People have always been kind of fixated on what big money is and who's got it and who doesn't and what it means. Mm-hmm. Paul, tell us first, how did you go about doing this survey? How do you get the wealthy to sort of open their hearts and all the rest about, you know, living that life? How do you do it?
First of all, the biggest trouble is getting access. But once you get access to one person who finds out that the questions really are helpful to them to reflect, they discover answers to questions that they've been mulling over just by being able to vocalize it. And then they refer you to others. And so you have kind of a branching sample. And that means that it's not necessarily random. We end up with people who are always human, but we end up with people in this study who are particularly wealthy, but also particularly philanthropic. So that's the kind of bias in our sample.
Okay, bias is in that direction. What's the cutoff here? Who are you talking to? Households with what kind of...
25 million and more, although it turns out that in the sample, we have a few households that didn't have that. But there's about 120,000 households in the United States that meet that criterion.
120,000 households with a net worth of 25 million plus.
Yes.
And I assume we're talking high... there's lots of room for plus here. I mean... Right. Wealth in this country, you look at the top Forbes 400, 500, you're up in the billions in a hurry.
Absolutely. And when you get to 100,000, 100 million, you're talking about 10,000 households. And it can accelerate once this recession turns around.
Bob, how does this survey work? What kind of questions are on it? How did you put it to the wealthy individuals who responded?
Well, it was an interesting and long process of designing the survey and finding out what kind of questions we wanted to ask. Some of them were very quantitative. Some of them were asking how much do they have, how much do they give away, how is this invested, are they... And then there was another section that we spent a lot of time on, the qualitative open-ended questions, where we really wanted to know what is the motivation for this particular population with, I think the mean was $33 million net worth, right?
Okay.
So we asked them a very simple, straightforward question that was discussed for many, many weeks. What is their greatest motivation? What is their greatest motivation in life? Period. That's all we asked.
Yeah.
That
and many other questions.
And many other questions. But that was the lead main question. What is your greatest motivation in life? We were really interested in knowing what it was. We were hoping it was philanthropy, but we didn't know what it was. And the overwhelming response to that question was they wanted to be good parents.
They wanted to be good parents. The same thing anybody else would say.
Exactly. That's right. And they were very good at articulating what that meant. They wanted their kids to live meaningful lives, had great relationships, good families, make contributions to their communities. These are the things that they wanted their kids to be able to do.
Paul, they're answering these questions online. So when you looked at their challenge in this number one motivation to be good parents, how did it look to you, like and unlike the challenges faced by people who may not have a net worth of $25 million, $33 million, $100 million?
That's exactly the question that I'm sure so many listeners are concerned about. And one of the things that Bob is suggesting is when I talked about it's hard to find people, but once you start to find them, they are very interested in talking because they never get a chance to express these things to somebody that's going to ask follow-up questions. Mm-hmm. And in this study, we not only asked them the question that Bob said, we followed up and asking them, what is the greatest thing that money has done for you and the worst thing? What is the greatest thing it's done for your children and the worst thing? And what is it the greatest thing it's done for the world and the worst thing?
Well, we began on children, so let's go there. What kind of thing did you hear the greatest thing your big money has done for your children, the worst thing it's done for or to your children?
It comes from the very same source. What money does to your children is it provides them with choice. And it provides them with a psychological range of thinking that they are either privileged or responsible. It can go either way. And it can be in different ways at different parts of their lives. Some parents think that their kids have turned out to be very entitled. Others think that their children have been better parents than they've been and are already more philanthropic than they were at their age. And so anything you can think of as a problem, except money, for all of us across the spectrum that have children, shows up in these answers. And Bob has mentioned this to me many times, and maybe he ought to comment on it, is that many of us aspire to be wealthy. Some people say, I don't ever want it. This is exactly what we're showing, the downside. But there is a tremendous upside, and it all comes from the ability to have material choice that puts on you the responsibility and your children to make a good choice about the quality of things that you're going to choose. And that's the dilemma for them.
What do you mean by quality? The quality of the yacht you buy?
Yes, you can, the quality of your choices.
But let's be clear on that one. I mean, I read all of these things many, many times.
Yeah.
No one ever mentioned a yacht. No one ever mentioned how many homes.
Somebody buys all those yachts.
Well, somebody buys all those yachts. But a lot of people are selling them, right? But when we're asking people at 11 o'clock at night, if they're at home, online, in an anonymous way, what do they really care about? They care about their children. They care about their communities. They care about what the dilemmas that their children are going to face as they get older. It's not just that they won't be motivated. Will they, in fact, have the impact in the world that they want to have?
What's the particular challenge of raising kids when you've got a whole ton of money in the bank? What's the particular challenge of that, Bob?
There's any number of them, but one of them is the sense of isolation, the sense of you're different because you have all this money, and I'm just a fourth grader trying to play soccer.
So who you're isolated there from?
Well, you're isolated from most of the people who think that if you have $40 million that you're different, and that somehow you don't have the same difficulties and some of the same challenges that have.
Does that kick in fourth grade on the soccer field?
It kicks in at different points in time when it comes to fundraisers in school. It gets kicked into how people treat, what other parents say about that particular family. Oh, they have this and they have that. As we get older, of course, it gets much more challenging when you're starting to date and you're trying to figure out who your friends are.
What's the challenge there?
The challenge is, are they dating me because of who I am and my unique personality? Are they dating me because my father has $45 million and everyone knows it? I mean, is there something else that goes through that? There's a way of stereotyping and distancing from the everyday community.
Paul, what about that isolation problem as you go through life with money? I mean, I'm sure a lot of people are shaking their heads and say, oh, boy, you know, yeah, I'll suffer that.
I have heard that in several interviews that I've done, intensive interviews. But the major thing, unlike Europe where people are worried about being kidnapped and having their children be kidnapped and in the Middle East and so on, our wealth holders are not shy and the children are not shy about being known as having this money.
Well, that's an act of grace by everybody else in the country that's not rich. We're still quite open to the wealthy. American culture says, okay, fine, you're rich.
That's right. And what I want to point out is that the parents and children have the following kind of three or four areas that the parents are trying to instill and the children are either learning or not learning. Okay. One of them is the area of consumption. And that can go awry, or people can learn that that is only one part of what money can provide.
Can go awry because when there's no limit to the money, there's no limit to the consumption, in effect.
Right. And it can be actually quite contradictory in the message of the parents. One person I interviewed said, I'm not going to give you, he's talking to his son, the BMW unless you get all A's. Now, you see both the demand to be disciplined and virtuous in your studies,
right.
and then the contradiction about what you get.
Then the bauble is pretty fancy. Right?
Yeah, I mean, it's not a dollar that we used to get for our A's.
Or an ice cream sundae for straight A's.
A second area is that they want them to understand industriousness and work. And that can go awry, or it can be a great learning and teaching. Third, they want their kids to have an attitude about caring for others, philanthropy. And that can go awry with the children actually doing philanthropy that may not be that caring.
Sort of write a check and who gives a hoot? That
or,
sort of thing.
Or even ending up with foundations in which the children or the parents are the employees and are self-dealing. I mean, you see all of this that can occur.
Yeah.
So where there's great money, there's the great opportunity for not only the bees and the bears to gather around that honey, but for the pigs, too.
We're in the money. We're in the money. We've got a lot of what it takes to get along. We're in the money. The skies are sunny. Old man depression, you are through. You've done us wrong.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the real lives of the rich and super rich, their millions, their billions, their anxiety, isolation, joys, fears. A new survey tells the story. Paul Shervish and Robert Bob Kenny are with me in the studio. They're with the Center on Wealth and Philanthropy at Boston College. Bob also with Northbridge Advisory Group. They've done a big survey of households with 25 million plus in net worth and how they look out on life. Of course, the country never tires of thinking about money. Look at the movies. It's all over the place. Here's Michael Douglas playing Gordon Gekko in the 2010 sequel, Wall Street Money Never Sleeps. Shia LaBeouf plays young Wall Street trader Jake Moore.
So what about money, Jake?
Sure.
You like her?
Do I like her? I've never thought about money as a she.
Oh. She lies there in bed at night with you, looking at you, one eye open. Money never sleeps. And she's jealous. And if you don't pay close attention, you wake up in the morning, she might be gone forever.
Michael Douglas back there as Gordon Gekko. What about just on the issue of money itself? There are millions and millions in this country right now, we all know it, who have no job whatsoever, who may have been foreclosed on, up against no home, I mean, with really, really rough issues about money. Now, we're looking at people who've got piles of money. Does that mean they think less about money, Bob Kenny, or more? Can you tell?
Well, we can't be absolutely sure, but our experiences and things they tell us that the wealthy think about money a lot, too. Just as the people who don't have any money, they worry about the impact that it's going to have. They worry about whether someone's going to take advantage of them, whether people really like them for themselves or what they're going to give to their favorite charity, if they're going to help them fund their latest project. Are they coming to see them? Are they inviting them to places because of their money, because of who they are? How is it invested? What if I lose it? I've been given this great opportunity to make some differences in the world. How do I make the best choices? How do I make the best impact in the world?
Is that liberating or imprisoning? I mean, once you've got that pile of money, do you find in your survey that people are obsessed with the fact that they could lose it and be like everybody else again, Paul?
Well, don't forget that the people in our survey generally are so high with their wealth. Now, one of the things that must be
hard to fall off that cliff. There's much money there.
But it isn't impossible until you get a little bit higher. And let me tell you why. When you get to a 25 million or more in net worth, on average, about 30% of their net worth is in a personal business, a private business.
Okay.
And when you get to 100 million, it's 50% on average. So
if the business goes down, you're all right anyway. If you're at 100 million,
that's right. But you also could be, in addition to a business, real estate. And in 2000, that recession, real estate didn't plummet. But this time, we had stock market plummet as well as real estate. But this isn't a story of poor little rich girl mm-hmm. and poor little rich boy.
Mm-hmm.
You know Pearl Bailey when she said, I've been poor and I've been rich, I'd rather be rich.
Just about everybody would as far as yes. the public understanding
And some
goes.
People say, I would never want to be rich with all those problems. But most of us would say, give me a shot. And so you said it just right. It's paradise or emptiness. Now, that's not a whole life. It could be paradise in one part of your mm-hmm. life and emptiness in another. It could be paradise with two of your children and emptiness with another. And it could be paradise about your marriage or it could be terrible about your marriage in those very same situations. Wealth is like electricity or like fire. It can provide great comfort, great assistance in life, or it can be death-dealing.
When it burns, when it's death-dealing, how, why, how does it conduit the emptiness in?
Well, when it's death-dealing, people are experiencing that what wealth can do is to affect the lives of other people. And when those other people are found to be, especially your children, critical of you, you weren't around when I was a kid. You're happier in taking care of other people with your philanthropy, more joyous about that than you are about me as your child.
Mm-hmm.
It's not about the money always,
mm-hmm.
but there is this equality of love being money. And parents can make it work that way on the downside, and kids can receive it that way on the downside. But there's all these things that I hope we can get to talk about what are the benefits of this great wealth. And again, it revolves around, as you indicated, this grand amount of freedom from, freedom to, and choice. And when you have that much choice, it not only affects your life, it affects the lives of other people.
We've got a lot of callers coming in here. I want to get to them, but we've got a lot of comments online, too, at onpointradio.org, and really interesting comments. Let me just pick one out of this huge stack here. This is from Constance, and she says, as a recently retired teacher struggling to be a self-employed consultant, this is a discussion that makes me crazy. They may have issues, but they don't have to worry about mortgage payments, car payments, necessary improvements on the house, taxes. There are just too many of us worrying daily to be concerned about the upper rich. I watch mega mansions being built in my area, and I want to ask, who are these people? I mean, Bob, why would anybody care?
Well, I think one of the reasons that I care and why I do this work and why Paul does this work is to try to understand what the inner life is of people who are building mega mansions. And I just want to clarify, when I say that the wealthy think about money as much as the poor do, they don't think about it in the same way. They think about it and they don't necessarily worry about losing it or not having it. They worry about what is the most productive way that they can use it. They understand it's a responsibility. They really want to, in some ways, improve the world to make an impact.
How much did you see in the survey results an awareness or concern about inequity in this country when so many have no job, maybe have no house, you know, don't know how they're going to hold body and soul together? Is that on the minds of
It was certainly on the minds of people, especially when they talked about parenting and their children. They were worried about their children not having enough empathy. How are they going to teach their children empathy when they realize they could have anything they want, that this isn't the way most people in the world live? How do we get people involved in some kind of philanthropic, altruistic behavior? How do we help them understand that they live a very rare and privileged life without them becoming the stereotype of sailing around the world with a case of scotch?
Let's go to our listeners. Sam in Malden, Massachusetts. Sam, thank you for calling. You're on the air, Sam.
Hey, hi. Thanks for taking my call today.
Yeah.
Great topic. I was wondering if your researchers made a distinction between people who worked, you know, to make this money, as opposed to people who are just handed the money, you either inherited it or, I mean, not that I can imagine how it's at all possible to work and make $25 million, but obviously someone works and makes that kind of money.
Yeah, if you had the right stock options in the right company at the right time, it could happen. So,
I guess.
Yeah.
It's hard to know how you could work and honestly make that kind of money.
Well.
Is there a distinction between people who worked and people who just lucked into inheriting some money?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Thank you, Sam. Paul, how about it? Those who, like, self-made gazillionaires and those who inherited or just kind of got lucky?
Most of the gazillionaires are self-made. Now, you have the Walton family, worth about five times $20 billion each, okay?
Oh, my gosh. And it wasn't them. It was Sam who made the money.
Yes. But on the other hand, 70% to 80% of all the people in this group are self-made.
I mean, they made the money in their lifetime.
That's right. And that is where big bucks get achieved today.
What about the difference between those who did then make it that way and those who inherited or sort of kind of got a lucky break?
Well, one of the things that wealthers will always talk about as part of their biography, and this gets to your question about equity too, they will always talk about what they have done as a mixture of discipline and virtue and hard work, and then they will tell you equally about breaks, luck, grace, right time, right place, a buddy who helped them.
They're so clear, they're so honest about that?
See, I thought at first that they weren't being honest about that.
Mm-hmm.
And they weren't being honest about the gratitude that they feel.
Mm-hmm.
Now, don't forget, there's a whole distribution here. Some are, some aren't. But when I started to ask follow-up questions, and this is one of the biggest things I discovered, that is not a false concern. And the area of equity that they want to talk about, and they don't know another way of doing it, is employing people and trying to encourage education for people in the inner city. And that's not all wealth holders. Now, in a capitalist society, I regret those are the only two ways that we're going to be working on distribution at this time and in this political environment.
Well, jobs and education are pretty good for starters. Of course, you know, we know how much lobbying goes on out there to sustain wealth and keep wealth concentrated. There's a big effort, corporate and otherwise, for that. But on this question of self-made or inheriting, for those who didn't make it themselves, Bob, or those who feel like they got lucky in their wealth, are there different issues that arise in how they face life?
Well, I think the issues are different, and sometimes it's a little bit more sudden. We had a subsample of our survey of people who married some guys that came out of college and worked for a very small internet firm somewhere, and it turned out to either be Dell or Microsoft.
Ba-boom,
and the next
boom.
Thing you know, they had these stock options that were worth $25 or $30 million, and they had to figure out, how am I going to deal with this money? What is the best thing for me to do? What's the effect it's going to have?
What about kids who inherit it?
Kids that inherit it also have, there's an awful lot. First of all, if you inherit a significant amount of like this, you probably grew up with an entrepreneur, and that's always an interesting experience all by itself. And then, again, you have to think, this is money that was given to me. I didn't earn it. I have some responsibility for it. What's the best way for me to use this money? How is it going to have the biggest impact? I think they think faster. But I think there's also an entire developmental phase that people go through trying to figure out, how do I make sense in my life, in this culture, that I have all this money? Because the culture basically says, if you have all this money, you should be fine. Well, why do I not feel fine today? There must be something really wrong with me.
You guys, looking at your biographies, didn't grow up with money. So what's the difference if you inherit that $25 million or $100 million in terms of, you know, sort of getting launched as an adult with a meaningful life? What's the difference?
They struggle with that meaningful life. I mean, and there is a difference between the old blue blood inherited generation after generation, let's say three or four. And what is occurring today, through our research, we're finding this great wealth transfer that's going to take place. And indeed, those of us in the baby boom generation are going to receive the largest transfer in history.
Yeah, but most of those won't be $25 million pots.
Well, 7% of the population is going to get two-thirds of that trillions and trillions of dollars.
Yeah.
So it's going to be concentrated. So your question is well taken. But here's the difference. In the past, inherited people did not develop a professional life on their own. And today...
You mean they just sort of played polo and hung out with, I don't know,
They were more focused on consumption, but then would find a full-time job in philanthropy.
I see. And now?
And now that's occurring also. But in the meantime, many of them are carrying out their own professional lives and using some of that money for investment.
But is that hard to stick with when you've got all that money to invest on the side? I mean, I remember the early the early years of my own working life. It was tough. I was working long, long hours. I was making very little money. If I had had 25 or 100 or 500 million to fall back on, I don't know if I would have stuck with it.
Would you have started your own firm with an idea that you thought was great?
Well, maybe, but then if you've got all that money, you don't have to have a great idea to start.
If you believe that the only motivation that people have is to make money. I mean, I remember back in the 80s.
Or to have it.
Or to have it. I remember in the 80s, my first experience with this dilemma was walking behind his Eunice Kennedy Shriver at the Kennedy Foundation. Yeah. And she's walking down and she's wringing her hands. And she's saying, there are so many problems in the world and we're such a small foundation. Right, and she was working 9 to 9 every day, she and Sarge all the time. They could have stayed home. They didn't. They were motivated. They knew it was important to them, and they went after it.
Well, bless them. Some do, some don't. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let's get a call right here from Cincinnati, Ohio. Dale, thanks for calling, Dale. You're on the air.
Hello. How are you doing, dude?
Pretty well. What do you know, Dale?
I started off, I never got up to the $25 million bracket. I was trying. During my first marriage, I started with nothing, came out of the military and started, and I wanted to provide for my family. And, I got married with 10 kids, which we did. And I started making more and more money. And I discovered that when I was broke, I had about 2 dozen friends. We didn't have much, but we got together. The more money I made, the more friends I had, it seemed like. I got up to over $660,000 before my divorce. And during the divorce, my wife took half of it, and then she turned around and sued me for half for child support and household maintenance and all that. And I discovered that when my mom disappeared, all my friends disappeared, and with it took about 20 of my original 24 friends I started with. So,
hey, Dale, you're breaking up on us, but I appreciate that witness you're giving us there. When the money went away, the friends went away in Dale's case. Do you find that fact or that concern in your survey, Bob?
Yes, the concern is there, definitely, that people have to tease out how many people are inviting me, how are my friends are asking for my opinion because I have the capacity to give them, lend them, or donate some money or not.
When does that show up, Paul? At what age does that start to become a factor?
I think it's there at every point. You heard him discuss his marriage. Now, that could be 3 years. Look at all the celebrities and all the sports players that go through this as a serial monogamy, and they are experiencing this breakup and reunion with somebody else several times, and it could start very young, 17, 20, 25, if you have the money, right? And the point is that, once again, what is the center of the problem of marriage? You're at the center of the family life again. And it is very important to understand that our other research with regular people and interviews with them indicate that these are precisely the concerns. When people who have lost their homes for the mortgage crisis that we had, when people are out of their jobs, what they are worried about is their family. And that is what humanizes the view in our society of those who are at the bottom. It humanizes them just like we humanize the people that we assist overseas. In Haiti, in New Orleans, and so on, in these
disasters. But it's one thing to care for your family and another not to be able to feed them or put a roof over their head or get them a decent education. Isn't that that's a different order of concern?
Absolutely. And that is something that concerns me as one of my top priorities is education of kids in the inner city that are stuck.
Every time I close my eyes, what you see?
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the real lives of the rich and the super rich. Their millions, their billions, their anxiety, isolation, good times, fears. A new survey tells the story. It is interesting. It may be galling to some ears in a time of foreclosure and unemployment and poverty. Yet, look at the numbers. It's a big reality in this country over the last several decades. An enormous concentration of wealth rocked around by the crisis of the last couple of years, but an awful lot has been rocked around. We're looking at what they tell when they're surveyed about their life, their motivations, their aspirations, talking with Paul Shervish and Bob Kenny. They work with the Center on Wealth and Philanthropy at Boston College, out with a big survey of households with $25 million and up, and we're talking way up here in their wealth, how they see, how they experience life. Let's go to Paul in Milton, Massachusetts. Paul, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I appreciate you taking my call. I've been a professional fundraiser for 25 years or so.
Okay.
And I can, I'd like to say that I think a great many of the concerns that your specialists speak about for the wealthy could be assuaged if, in fact, they thought more about other people. I understand it's only human to be take care of self-interest, but having talked to many, many, many very wealthy people, and, you know, a million is the bottom of the barrel, not the top.
Yep.
Getting these folks to think about other people and to actually be really, really generous as a percentage of their total income is really very, very challenging. And if they would just open their hearts and open their minds and really put those resources to use instead of worrying about the next Lexus in the household, I think they'd find some personal growth and some personal satisfaction.
But you've worked in this field for a long time, it sounds like, Paul. Why do you think that's so difficult? I mean, we live in a time when the need is certainly obvious and gigantic. It wouldn't seem to be so hard to kind of look out and say, wow, let's see what I can do with this material wealth.
Well, exactly. It isn't hard, but what is it about people who have this tremendous wealth that keeps them from doing that? And I would opine on that the message that society as a whole, our leaders in society, do such a tremendously bad job at leading by example and protecting the message, the ethical message that being rich is good, when in fact being rich is just so people have a tool. That's all money is. Money is a tool.
Paul, stand by if you'd be good enough. I want to put this to Paul Shervish, who's with me in the studio. Here's our caller, Paul, who's worked in these vineyards for a long, long time. He wishes he saw more empathy, more generosity. You found it, and you say your survey may be biased toward people who lean that way, but he wishes he saw more and can't understand why it's not there.
Every fundraiser wishes they could see more.
Well, that seems too easy.
No, it isn't too easy because, first of all, top 3% of the population contributes 40% of all the charitable dollars. The other thing is, if you want your money to be productive, you can buy a Lexus, you can buy 10 Lexuses, and you still got as much money to give away as we dream about. Now, what we find is that as you go up the income scale, as you go up the wealth scale, those that have settled and have moved from accumulation to allocation, it's a major finding.
Okay.
Those that feel that they have settled financial security give dramatically more than those who are in the middle of moving toward that financial security. In the last 25 years, there has been such a dramatic growth in the amount of charitable giving that has taken place. Now, we can always say there could be more, but you look at the major institutions, you look at the generosity for all the crises and natural disasters. All of this is largely coming from the upper end. However,
I know an awful lot of people of low and modest incomes who chipped in for Katrina and you name it, Haiti, you name it.
Absolutely. And in fact, when you look at the lower end, you find out that their formal philanthropy is only one-fifth of all the financial care that they do. I'm not talking about Christmas presents. I'm not talking about weddings. I'm talking about their care of their parents, care of their children, not living with them, care of friends. And so we find that while their charitable giving is just about the average in a nation, I'm talking about...
You're talking rich or poor or middle?
Middle.
Okay.
Middle and poor. They give five times in kind gifts and in money than what they give in formal charity.
Formal charity donations.
And at the bottom, $90 billion goes overseas. People wonder why the immigrants aren't high on the contribution levels. $90 billion from United States people living in the country.
You're talking about repatriated money included in that.
Remittances.
Paul, stand by. Caller Paul, weigh in here. You know, you hear my guest Paul Shervis saying, yeah, every fundraiser wants more from the rich, but the rich are shelling it out hand over fist.
Oh, please, spare me. Of course they're shelling it out hand over fist as a percentage of the total giving because they can. My point is that they should be shelling it out as a percentage of what they have, and that is not happening. And I would challenge Paul to find statistics that say that, because the absolute reality is that, you know, as the joke goes in philanthropy, the rich don't stay rich by giving their money away. And if they want to make a real difference, they should cut in substantially to the capital, not just the growth, not just the dividends from their Microsoft, you know, stock options. Cut into the capital. Go without the 9 of the 10 Lexuses. Tell little Junior that little Junior needs to drive a Corolla instead of a Mercedes 400, which we see lots of on private college campuses these days. So please spare me the statistical analysis of the wealthy being the leaders in philanthropy in this country, because as a percentage of what they have, they absolutely are not.
Paul, I appreciate your call very much. Very much indeed. Thank you so much. Bob Kenny, what about this issue of capital? Like, you know, don't just spend the dividend on philanthropy. Cut into capital, sort of the core of what the wealthy have. Is it your impression from the responses to this survey that these wealthy families expect and or intend that their family will be wealthy forever? Generation after generation? Does that become instantly the kind of, you know, goal? Lock it up, let's go?
Sometimes that's locked in, but I think that's locked in as much by the bankers and the people managing the money than the people who actually own the money. There's another whole segment there. One of the things that we've seen again and again, and I think I'd like to emphasize, is that this is not a static. This isn't a picture. It's moving and it's dynamic. One of the things that struck me is that so many people said, I've just started to figure out not only how much money I actually have, but what that means. What that means as far as I can live a certain way the rest of my life and I have all this money to give away. People, there's a kind of...
But our caller's saying, what about the capital? What about not just what you're spinning
off
every
year? No, they go beyond that. I mean, it's
he's just simply wrong about that.
Yeah.
There's the tremendous growth in foundations. When you get to final estates, 50% in some years, but it ranges between 40% and 50%. Of the value of estates where 25 million or more, goes to charity. And that's capital, and that's after there's been this great growth in foundations. Now, he can complain that he's not getting the money, but when people take their capital, they're putting it into foundations. And there's a debate about whether that money in foundations should be distributed more quickly and in larger amounts over a shorter period of time. But that capital has turned into philanthropy is one thing that is true. Second, I don't care how much you think you want the money from one Lexus. You can talk to fundraiser after fundraiser that have exactly the opposite experience. And one of the things that makes fundraising more successful is not having this kind of scolding model. We find that when people are engaged biographically by fundraisers who are asking and not telling.
Courtiers.
Well, and that really stimulates philanthropy. Talk to the people at the major universities, at major hospitals. Talk to the people at the Red Cross. Great contributions from the lower end.
I'm sure people have become very good at singing the song.
And the billion-dollar club that Bill Gates has, where people have committed to give 50% of their wealth to charity.
Yeah, for that big one. Let me get a call here from Stevensville, Montana. Patricia, thank you very much for calling, Patricia. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. I have just two quick comments. One is that, you know, I'm in my 50s, and this country has become something that I don't really even recognize anymore. Do we really want a country where we have a very few benefactors that decide themselves how they will dole out their uber wealth to the rest of us in order to make this country feel abundant and serviced and all of these things. And what about that socialist Eisenhower who had a tax rate of 91% on those wealthy people? I mean, where is the equity when it just comes from those super wealthy people? We're depending on this very small percentage of people to make the rest of our country one that feels happy to be living here.
Patricia, I so appreciate your call. Thank you very much for that. Bob Kenny, let me ask you about political consciousness in the survey. I mean, you know, you've got some very high-blown questions here about aspirations and so on, but did you see a profile of political consciousness that might, among this set, among this class, that might be concerned about distribution of income and wealth in this country as an indicator of national health? You hear Patricia's concern that get all this concentration, and then it's all about, oh my gosh, how much will they hand down to the rest?
Yes, there was a concern in a lot of our responses, but it goes much when they went far beyond being concerned about it. How do you actually do it? Is it where do you give the money? What's the best way to use the money so that we can actually change this disparity in distribution isn't really serving anyone in this
country. That's great, but that's still about philanthropy if it's there and being the benefactor. But what about the political structure of the country itself and the economic structure that has produced one of our greater ages of the concentration of wealth? Do you see them thinking about that? Maybe that, you know, may have been good for their family, but is it good for the country?
Well, I think what they're struggling with is what is the best way to change the way the country is going and the direction it's going. And I think again and again we saw that they believe that a good education for everyone was the best way to make the democracy strong. In the process of making the democracy strong and the society stronger, that we could address some of those policy and economic issues.
Let's get a call from New York, Peru, New York. Mike, thanks for calling. Mike, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
All right. What do you know?
I had a friend of mine who was wealthy, and she was from California. She was related to Folgers Coffee.
Okay.
And Folgers was bought out by Procter & Gamble's, and she had oodles of Procter & Gamble's stock.
Yeah, okay.
And I used to tell everybody that I was her bag boy, and she'd take me on these great trips all over the place. Mm-hmm. And, you know, not terrifically, but, you know, once a year, maybe twice a year, we'd go someplace. And
lucky you.
She just passed away in December. But she, just the phenomenal responsibility. She handled her money. Yes, it was in stocks, but she handled it. And
you mean the responsibility of what? Of giving it away or of sustaining it? Or what responsibility, Mike?
Well, that's the thing. One of the things we did was we'd go down to Cabo San Lucas, and there were two or three people down there that she was good friends with, and it was just like, give me your money, you know? I mean, it was just like dreaming up ways and things to spend it on.
So on balance, would you have liked to had her money or not, Mike? What do you think?
Yeah, that's a good point. That's kind of the reality. Could I handle that kind of responsibility? And partially, I think it was because she had a tendency to hang out with people that weren't ultra-rich, so they didn't respect her, and they just wanted money, and they needed it.
My guests are nodding along here today, recognizing that environment. Let me get one more. Danielle in Sheffield, Vermont. Thank you, Mike. Danielle, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. Our time is short. Tell us your story.
Sure. I have a half-brother who is 20 years younger than myself, and he is... So he's 22, and he is involved. Now our family has more money than it did when I was growing up, and he has been handed everything to him on a silver platter. And I think because of that, he has absolutely no motivation. And it's kind of sad. He's a wonderful human being, but he really can't do anything for himself. He learned to fry an egg when he was 20.
The motivation, Daniel. I appreciate your call. This comes up a lot in what I'm seeing in the survey. I mean, when in this case, it's handed to a young man, and motivation. I mean, motivation in the end, Paul. Motivation is the heart of life, right? That's where we take our our meaning. I read through this survey. Sure, everybody says I'd like to have money, but I have to admit I wasn't so sure. I kind of felt less drawn to that big money after reading the responses. Mm-hmm. There are great things about it. On the other hand, there's something about working and making your way in life day by day that gives exactly that motivation that gives meaning.
See, I think you put your finger exactly on it. What is common across the economic spectrum is that people have capacities, larger or smaller capacities. It could be a physical capacity, it could be good looks, it could be art, it could be singing, it could be money. And then they have aspirations, you say motivations. And when you implement, all these things are passive, all these capacities are passive, to you implement them with your aspirations.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what's common. This caller just mentioned somebody with great capacity, but low aspirations.
A lot of money, no motivation.
And it's the combination of those two that bring together what you indicated was the moral question. That's a moral biography, putting your capacities to work by proper purpose, and that's true across the economic spectrum.
There's a kind of challenge right there, maybe greatest of all, if you've got all that money, how to keep everything in balance, and the whole country looking at wealth and its concentration these days. Paul Shervish and Robert Kenny, I want to thank both of you for being with us today. Thank you so much for reporting in on your survey. Thanks for joining us, Paul.
What a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul.
You're welcome. Paul.
We'll go out with Tony Bennett with Plenty of Money and You.